This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ihez Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In Zimbabwe, we are witnessing, obviously, attacks on the judiciary. There is obviously a lot more manipulation of the lower courts.
That's Stanley Nyamanhindi, CEO of the SADC Lawyers Association, on concerns about political interference in judicial matters in Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Eswatini. Details coming up. Also, after 10 years in exile, Ivory Coast's former president, Laurent Gbagbo, returns home today. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. The man known as Zambia's founding father has died at the age of 97. Kenneth Kaunda rose to power during Africa's heady post-independence period when dozens of former European colonies gained their freedom. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg on the death of the African giant.
He was one of the last of a dying generation of African liberation leaders. Kenneth Kaunda served as the first president of the Southern African nation of Zambia after it gained independence from Britain in 1964. He held the post until 1991. But his influence goes much wider, says Ghana-based lawyer Safo Abrebrese, who heads the Coalition of Supporters Unions of Africa.
Kenneth Kaunda continued with the fight against colonialism and played a leading role in discipling the likes of Nelson Mandela, the likes of Robert Mugabe, the likes of Sam Nujoma, and others to bring independence to the Southern African nations, just as Kwame Nkrumah did in West Africa. It is safe to say that as Kwame Nkrumah was in West Africa, so was Kenneth Kaunda in Southern Africa. His legacy lasts not in a lifetime, but it lasts forever.
A passion for equality was central to Kaunda's vision of a modern Zambia, a landlocked nation with dozens of languages and ethnicities, says Dr. Emmanuel Matambo, professor at the University of Johannesburg.
He always promoted this motto of Zambia being one Zambia and one nation, because he managed to forge a nation out of a group of very disparate ethnic dialects, and that has been quite an achievement on the African continent, not only in Zambia.
Kaunda was born in 1924, the youngest of eight children of missionary teachers from neighboring Malawi. Like fellow post-independence leaders Julius Nyerere of Tanzania and Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, Kaunda began his career as a teacher before shifting to politics. Some say he set up his small country for success. Others say he leaves a mixed legacy. Matambo says that may be because of the immense pressure put on Africa by global and regional events, from as far away as the Soviet Union to as close as South Africa. In the battle against the unjust apartheid system, says Pan-African activist Daniel Mobonu, Kaunda also was a leading light.
By his contribution in raising awareness on what was happening in South Africa, he made the world understand the harsh realities of apartheid in South Africa, and was a voice for South Africans at the United Nations. He made the UN and the UN understand the harsh realities of apartheid in South Africa.
Kaunda remained active after his retirement, campaigning with HIV/AIDS organizations and as an elder statesman in his country and the region. In recent years, he made fewer public appearances, attending the funerals of Mugabe and of South African icon Nelson Mandela, his contemporaries during this triumphant and turbulent century in African history. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A report by some of Zimbabwe's leading academic and researchers say the country's political elite, in collaboration with several private companies, have captured the country's rich mineral resources. The document, called Cartel Power Dynamics in Zimbabwe, has been published anonymously in South Africa because the authors fear government reprisals. The ruling ZANU-PF party hasn't responded in detail to the report's allegations, but has dismissed them as lies. Darren Taylor has more.
The Center for Natural Resource Governance in Zimbabwe is an organization striving for justice in the country's mineral sector. Founding director Farai Maguwu says a turning point came when then-President Robert Mugabe granted South African diamond mining giant De Beers exclusive prospecting rights in Eastern Marange District in 1993.
According to the law, they were supposed only to do exploration for 3 years, but their exploration license was extended inexplicably for 13 years until 2006, illegally, corruptly. In the meantime, as they were claiming to be prospecting, they were actually mining and shipping the diamonds out of the country.
Maguwu says the government was sharing the spoils with De Beers. It's something the companies always denied, maintaining its activities in Zimbabwe have been lawful. But, says Maguwu, the state's dealings with De Beers set the scene for the corruption that endures in Zimbabwe's mineral sphere.
And then in 2008, when the ruling elites felt it was their turn to eat, they deployed the military and the police and the CIO, and there was a massacre of hundreds of people so that they could capture the diamond fields.
At the time, international human rights monitors confirmed at least 200 deaths of people working the Marange fields. Remorseful soldiers also told journalists about their roles in the incident. Authorities deny such a massacre ever happened. In the aftermath, says Maguwu, 8 companies, including 3 from China and 1 from South Africa, began looting diamonds on behalf of the state. He says international diamond dealers didn't ask any questions when buying the gems for billions of US dollars. Maguwu says the firms and the government also stole money using a scheme that endures today, falsification of the value of diamonds.
Diamonds in Marange are 90% industrial quality and 10% gem quality. But when they report to the nation on what we are earning from our diamonds, it's always they are poor quality. They are sold at $40 per carat, which is very further from the truth.
Maguwu says big international mining firms continue to come into Zimbabwe.
So when we talk about the large-scale mines, these are negotiated in the office of the president. He is giving special grants to these people, mainly from China. It is only the president and the minister of mines who really know who these people are. So they are not answerable to parliament. They are not even answerable to the government as a whole. They are answerable to themselves.
He adds that the political elite is also allowing local allies in the private sector into mining, funding them through the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe.
And the loans are never repaid. It's actually a continuous robbing of the taxpayer, because ultimately these loans are going to be repaid by the Zimbabwean people, even though we are not privy to how these people are selected, how they end up accessing money from the treasury.
Maguwu says when he hears news reports describing Zimbabwe as one of the poorest countries on earth, he doesn't know whether to laugh or cry, because he says its resources, like gold, diamonds, and tobacco, should mean it's one of the wealthiest nations in Africa. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe has enacted another partial lockdown, which has stopped the seating of customers in restaurants, suspended sporting activities, and encouraged businesses and offices to reduce work space. Bulawayo-based reporter Kuzaiza Nawashi says the new measures have caught many unaware.
Minister of Information Monica Motswangwa links the increasing number of COVID-19 cases to the behavior of the public.
The surge is mostly attributable to the general complacency in adhering to the set COVID-19 preventive and precautionary measures, both in the communities and workplaces. Henceforth, the public is being advised that the police and other law enforcement agencies will increase roadblocks and patrols to ensure compliance with the recently announced COVID-19 containment measures.
The surge prompted the government to put in place a partial lockdown on Monday, which has left the sporting community and restaurants dumbfounded. Stan Higgins is an official with the Restaurant Operators Association of Zimbabwe.
There is a misperception that restaurants are unsafe places in this time of COVID. That's untrue. A well-run and well-managed restaurant has a standard of hygiene that is far superior than to any other business operation that you can think of. In the past year, when restaurants have allowed to be open, they have adhered to the correct practices, social distancing, sanitizing, masks. So it's unfair when, for example, you can go and do shopping in a supermarket or you can go and transact business in any other kind of business environment, which is less safe.
The Zimbabwe cricket team was in the middle of a four-day match with South Africa when the lockdown was put in place. Although they complied with the directive, they appealed the decision to government through the Sports and Recreation Commission. The appeal has since been successful, with government allowing low-contact sports such as cricket, hockey, and other minority sports to continue. Dr. Norman Matara of the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights says the lockdown is necessary.
The cases were continuing to increase. The seven-day rolling average was always increasing for the past 4 weeks, as well as the positivity rate was also increasing. So there was an impending danger that was happening, and we actually need to be proactive. We do not need to wait until cases skyrocket to 500 cases per day or more than that. The regulations are important to stop the infection before they get out of hand.
Dr. Matara credits the government for trying to strike a balance between containing the spread and not stopping people from pursuing their economic activities. Higgins, on the other hand, worries that if the lockdown drags on, more people will be permanently losing their jobs, and it's very likely that some restaurants will stay shut. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvinavashe from Harare.
After 10 years of living in exile, former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo is returning home today. The French news agency AFP reports that Gbagbo left the country in humiliation in 2011 after he refused to accept electoral defeat to current President Alassane Ouattara. In the following months of conflict, around 3,000 people died. Later, Gbagbo was tried and acquitted for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity. Today, Gbagbo has been recast in the role of a statesman called upon to help national reconciliation after elections last year left scores dead. News reports say Ouattara facilitated Gbagbo's return, issuing his former rival with a diplomatic passport and promising him the rewards and status due to ex-presidents. Gbagbo, age 76, has said little about what political role he might play. The Southern African Development Community's Lawyers Association says it is worried by the state of judicial independence in Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Eswatini. They noted growing attacks on the judiciary, attempts to change the constitution without due process, and undue influence on judges in these countries. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Last Mainga Hama has started picking up pieces of his broken life after 8 years of incarceration for a crime he did not commit. The outspoken Movement for Democratic Change Alliance Party, MDC Alliance activist, and fellow party member Tungamirai Madzore were sentenced to 20 years by a Zimbabwean court for allegedly killing a police officer when party supporters had a standoff with the police in 2011. The Supreme Court has now acquitted them, and Mainga Hama says this is evidence that they were victims of state influence on the judiciary.
This must stop. Our police, our prosecutors, our judges, everyone who is involved in delivering justice, they must be professional. They are there to serve the interest of the country, not the interest of individuals or a political party. We do not want such a justice delivery system.
For Madzore, the experience has been extremely traumatic.
He says he was so much in love with his wife that they almost wedded while he was in prison. However, when he was acquitted, his wife and children had deserted him. These are just two examples of what the SADC Lawyers Association has described as worrying political interference in judicial matters. The association says it has noted with great concern the tendency by the state to use the judiciary to punish its opponents. The lawyers say they have noted with concern the denial of bail to government critics, even in circumstances where there is no legal basis to do so. Stanley Nyamanindi is the CEO of the association.
In Zimbabwe, we are witnessing, obviously, attacks on the judiciary. There is obviously a lot more manipulation of the lower courts. Things like if a judge has accepted a farm and is continuing to accept inputs to farm, obviously the challenge is that they may be compromised in their independence.
The country's Chief Justice, Luke Malaba, is embroiled in a court battle after President Emmerson Mnangagwa granted his request to work beyond his retirement age, which legal experts call a breach of the Constitution. The SADC Lawyers Association has raised concerns after the Minister of Justice, Ziyambi Ziyambi, described a judgment barring Malaba from extending his term of office as a judiciary capture by those who want to destabilize the Zimbabwean government. Political interference with court processes in Eswatini and Zambia have also been condemned, with the lawyers calling on the three countries to ensure judicial independence, separation of powers, and guarantees that judges are able to work without fear or favor. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Felix Tshisekedi, has been in the eastern part of the country over the past few days. His trip includes a meeting with Uganda's president, Yoweri Museveni, at their country's shared border. Journalist Jafar Al-Katanti is in Budya, the capital of Ituri province, in the eastern part of the country. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson a short time ago about Tshisekedi's visit.
First, the president came to Goma to visit people after the eruption. And from there, he also decided to do an evaluation of the state of siege, which is in North Kivu and Ituri. That's why he went also in the beginning of this week in Beni city to see people and talk to chief commands of the operation. And then he went to the border, in the city border of Kasindi, where he met the president of Uganda, Museveni, and together the two presidents talked, and then they launched the project of building a road, a tarmac, from Kasindi border to the big city of Goma.
It sounds like the president's visit with Mr. Museveni went really well. How is the public there in the Democratic Republic of Congo receiving or responding to that visit? Are they approving of his plans?
Yeah, for them, people of Beni and Kasindi, for them, that is a good idea and a good news, because that road will help them a lot. Congo need roads everywhere that we don't have roads, and as we depend by our neighbors, and we have to use that road to connect, to link Uganda with big cities of east of DRC. And another thing is the problem of security. As we don't have good roads, that's why rebels profit to attack cars. But with a good road, it will call slowly for security, because rebels could not attack a car running with high speed. So for people, that is a good thing, a good news for them. And everybody in the east of Beni was happy yesterday.
Now, he was originally scheduled to go to Bunia, but that trip has been postponed. He's been in Beni, and how has he been received? Is this trip being seen as successfully addressing the concerns of people?
The program of the president since he came in Goma is still changing every time. And it's like people now are okay with that, because here in Bunia, people was waiting for the president since yesterday. He didn't come by evening, so he's supposed to be in Bunia today, and all the city is waiting for the president. We can see everybody wearing a T-shirt with a political party name. We see also flags of politics name. So people are waiting for him, because Bunia in Ituri also, they are under the state of siege. So they want to hear from the president which are the results of the state of siege.
That was Jafar Al-Katanti reporting from Bunia in the Eastern DRC. He spoke with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. Botswana wants foreign prison inmates sent back to their home countries to serve the remainder of their sentences. Botswana has more than 500 foreign inmates and has held talks with respective countries in a bid to repatriate the prisoners. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
Commissioner of Prisons Diana Marate told a National Assembly Committee Monday the country's 524 foreign inmates among its total prison population of 3,882. Public Accounts Committee member and legislator Pono Mwatludi led concerns at the high number of foreign inmates, citing the burden on the Southern African country's budget. Marate said Botswana was already working with other countries to finalize legal instruments paving the way for prisoner exchanges.
We have bilateral agreements and memorandum of understanding that we have signed with other countries, especially in the SADC region, such that consideration be made that prisoners be transferred to their countries of origin.
Marate said countries are working on harmonizing laws to enable the process to take place.
What we are waiting for is the laws that would allow that process to take effect. So I believe once that has been done, it will help us a lot, because a lot of these people, they can be taken to their countries and cut our food ration.
Botswana battles an influx of illegal immigrants, particularly from neighboring Zimbabwe. In 2019, Botswana had 502 Zimbabwean prisoners, while only one Botswana national was incarcerated in a Zimbabwe prison. The two countries have already signed a memorandum of understanding for the exchange of prisoners. Meanwhile, Marate said Botswana will allow prisoners to communicate with their families through video conferencing facilities. This after the country banned in-person prison visits as a way to curb the spread of COVID-19. For VOA, this is Mkwandisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyus Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo, and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the internet.